IVM.
I said, I don't want to know what happened in the past. All I want to know is, who are my commanders? Where are the Chinese? How much ammunition have I got? How much oil, petroleum, and food have I got? I just leave the map to be here. Mr. Deep. After half an hour, I rang the bell, they came in, and I said, I don't know whether I'm doing right or wrong, but these are my orders. And that was the time when the chief of staff took his hat off, flung it on the ground, jumped on it. He said, thank effing God, at last somebody is giving orders. You've never had orders before.
Hello and welcome to States of Anarchy, a podcast on global affairs and foreign policy. I'm your host, Hamsini Hariharan. And every week on the show, I sit down with experts to discuss global affairs and foreign policy, all in the hope of making a little more sense of the world around us. The clip that you just heard was Field Marshal Sam Manekshaw talking about his experiences in the 1962 war. The Indian Armed Forces are among the most powerful in the world. Over the last 70 years, it's played an extremely important role in domestic and external struggles. While people across the country are extremely proud and also concerned about the state of our troops, our military history remains a topic that's been limited to academic and strategic circles or valorized in Bollywood's fiction. But there's a need to look beyond the political and the passionate narratives, to look at the Indian Armed Forces as a player that has confronted extremely unique challenges. So what does military history tell us about these men and women who safeguard our country? How has strategic thinking in India changed over the last few decades? And with the Galwan crisis, what does the future look like for the Indian military? I can honestly say that I can think of no better person to answer these questions than my guest for today's episode. Air Vice Marshal Arjun Subramaniam is a retired Air Vice Marshal from the Indian Air Force. He's an accomplished fighter pilot and is also a military historian, academic and strategic analyst, and an author. I first met him at the release of his last book, India's Wars, A Military History, 1947 to 1971, a couple of years ago. And now when he released his new book, Full Spectrum, I knew that I had to get him on the show, not only to speak about the book, but also to answer key questions about the Indian Armed Forces. We'll get to the conversation with AVM Arjun Subramaniam. But first, a short break. AVM, so welcome to States of Anarchy. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Hamsini, it's great to be on your show. And I do remember it 4 years ago when we were doing the same thing, but in a much more, you know, comfortable and much more informal environment at Takshashila.
Yes, I was thinking of that as well. And I was also thinking about that because we'd recorded the last podcast together right during the launch of India's Wars. And so it's pretty amazing that we've now come full circle with your new book, Full Spectrum. And my own impressions from reading the book is that both Full Spectrum and India's Wars are sort of similar. They have a very ambitious mandate, I think, of chronicling the story of the Indian Armed Forces and the various conflicts that India has gone through. And I think you've done it great justice. So something that I was reading about, and I was also listening to some of your other interviews, and you say that this is a book of applied military history. So how have you managed to research military history with all of the restrictions that national security and sensitive information bring with it?
Hamsini, you know, one of the first phrases that, or one of the most common phrases that I use about the book is an ambitious and sweeping landscape. And every time I started writing both the books, I always had this sinking feeling in my stomach of overreach. But then, you know, I always used to go back to the story of the Apollo program, in which every time astronauts went for training, they were told that unless you reach for the stars, you won't, you know, hit the sky, you won't hit the atmosphere itself. Mm. And therefore, I said, okay, let me take one step at a time. And I think I was quite satisfied at this overreach because it allowed me to create a sweeping kind of a landscape that gives everyone something of what the Indian Armed Forces is all about. Now, Coming to this issue that you broached on, how did I balance the stringent requirements of the Official Secrets Act and not seeming to engage in too much of advocacy, and at the same time not being hypercritical of people, events, and outcomes? That was the balance that I had to draw on while crafting this book. And that I did because this book is not a memoir. This book is not about justifying my own actions as a leader, as a commander. This is a plain vanilla military history offering with this whole concept of applied military history coming into the loop. So that's pretty much an introduction to the book. And I think you must be also interested in this whole concept of applied military history. Applied military history is only a recent phenomenon. It's a recent discipline that has emerged from the classical discipline of military history, because there are scholars, particularly in the United States, you know, scholars like Graham Allison and Neil Ferguson and the others, who felt that military history in the classical sense, as written by scholars like John Keegan and the others, needed to be tempered and sort of balanced with a lot of other disciplines that allows a more broad focus to the discipline of military history, that is actually required some kind of a interface between military history and strategic studies and IR and political science, so with a number of feeders in.
Yeah, and I think at the same time, a lot of these are also stories. You've extensively interviewed people and you're talking to them about their experiences and how it was to sort of be on the front lines of conflict. And I was wondering, for you, in your personal capacity, you served for 30 years in the Air Force, how did you sort of transition from being someone in the armed forces, you know, someone who was a fighter pilot, into academia and writing?
Well, Hamsini, my service tenure was a tad bit more than 30 years. In fact, I served...
My apologies.
I served 36 years. And if one adds on 3 years in the National Defense Academy and 5 years in a military school, it pretty much works out to 46 to 47 years in uniform, you know, which when I look back now, I really wonder how I did it. But talking about the transition, you know, every military officer understands that war is not desirable. Everyone understands that you train as much to avoid war as to take part in a war or to precipitate a conflict. But deep down inside, every soldier wants to actually cap his career with some action. And several of us don't get to see any action despite having trained for war and conflict throughout your service career. Now, here I was, somebody who from a very young age has been fascinated with military history. I always had a passion for the classics, you know, Achilles, Arjuna, Napoleon, Rommel, Timaya. These were all my heroes as I was a growing kid. And now, when you yourself don the uniform and realize that you have this skill to translate military history into narratives and stories, this was something that suddenly came to my realization pretty late in my career. And that was the start point for this transition from a practitioner to a scholar and an academic. And of course, you know, you have this building block process that you put yourself through. Very early on in my career, I started writing small stuff, flight safety. Then I graduated to air power. I had the privilege and the honor of being mentored by the late Air Commodore Jasjit Singh. He sort of opened up new vistas for me when it comes to putting pen to paper and for articulating myself on issues related to air power and the Indian Air Force and World War II and the various. So I started off being an air power historian and an air power analyst. But then sometime in 2012, I realized that, you know, I was feeling restless. I said I've done a lot of writing about air power, and there was this nagging desire to get back to military history, you know, get back to your core passion of military history. And then I looked around. I said, what is it in the Indian landscape that is missing? And what immediately came to my mind was that comprehensive, detailed narratives on contemporary Indian military history was completely missing from the overall historical discourse. And I said, this is an opportunity and this is a space that merits some amount of attention. Let me get down to writing some military history from a joint perspective, which has never been done before in India and very rarely been attempted even in the West. You know, even in the West, if you look at military history writing, it is either concentrated solely on land, sea, or air power, and not so much on joint operations. So I said, let me try and occupy these two niche areas and see how I can get along. Well, India's wars was a shot in the dark. And I said that let me build on that by writing the sequel. So that's the way I transited or made the transition from being a practitioner to a historian. And in between also, I realized my interest and passion in teaching. So I could teach military history at several schools in the US. I did teach a little bit of military history here as part of the strategic studies program at Ashoka University. I can't complain. I've been able to do what I've really been passionate about and wanted to do, apart from my core profession of being a fighter pilot.
I think that's rather wonderful, because one of the main things that the book also does is sometimes it takes these highly strategic things that are maybe common in academia and communicates them to citizens who might be interested in the history of their country, but don't necessarily know how to sort of investigate this history. And how have you found sort of civilian reactions to the book?
You know, I think it's very important for a writer to understand and target the readership right in the beginning before writing a book. For example, I was very clear that I wanted to write a hybrid narrative. And why did I want to write a hybrid narrative is because I wanted to write something that was acceptable to a wide constituency of readership. Now, many academics and many well-wishers alerted me to the fact that this could be a tightrope to walk on. And they argued that I may not be able to satisfy any single constituency of readership, and therefore, you know, the book may not live up to its potential, what it deserves. But then I had a chance meeting with Professor Dr. Lawrence Friedman at Oxford, and I explained my dilemma to Laurie, as he's known. And he said that, look, Arjun, my book on strategy, which is a huge 600-700 page book, was written exactly with this readership in mind. And therefore, if you have a plan for a hybrid narrative, just go ahead and do it. And don't worry about what academics tell you. Don't worry about what reviews you get in scholarly journals. Just go ahead and target the readership that you want to address. And that is why, it's interesting that you said that you delve or you deal with a lot of strategic issues, but have managed to break them down rather simply for the common reader. And that is why I liken my book to an orange. You know, it peels from the strategic to the operational and the tactical level before it settles down at its core, and that is people. Mm. And that's when you come back to what you had mentioned earlier, which is stories about people. And that is why I chose to adopt this sweeping hybrid kind of a style of writing.
Okay. No, I think that's good to know for us, particularly when we're reading the book. And now I suggest we peel back some layers in some of the themes that are there that you addressed. And I'm just also wondering if it's because the nature of threats are also constantly evolving. And with the pace of technology are evolving faster than ever before. I think one of the reasons that I really enjoyed your book is because Full Spectrum talks about the need that India has to deal with a full spectrum of conflict, be it conventional or subconventional, hybrid or limited and others. And so I'm just wondering, in terms of the last couple of decades, there has been a rise in counterinsurgency and counterterrorism and limited conflict. What role has this played in Indian strategic thinking?
It's had a huge impact on Indian strategic thinking. Till the 1980s, the Indian strategic community, like it was in the West, was comfortable with the idea of the big battle. it was comfortable with the idea of sequenced operation. It was comfortable with the idea of the fact that wars, the outcomes of wars, could be decided in terms of victories and defeats. It was comfortable with the idea of nation states going to war with one another. It was comfortable with diplomacy kicking in at a particular point when militaries either exhausted themselves or one state, you know, managed to extract an advantage from a military conflict. But then the last two decades have seen the expansion of the spectrum of conflict to accommodate many, many more players who were willing to challenge the might of the established state for various reasons, whether it is ethnic fault lines, whether it is religious fault lines, whether it is geographical fault lines. So there were several entities that sprung up across the world that was created, you know, and they sprung up because there was a vacuum created after the end of the Cold War. And that is when you had several genres of conflict below the levels of actual or conventional war that started manifesting itself, absolutely, proliferating across the world. And while I was doing my research, I realized that other than the United States and probably Israel, no other democracy in the post-World War II era has engaged in so much of conflict as the Indian state has done in order to protect what is dear to its people. So I will argue that much of the war and conflict that India has waged after its independence has been to protect what is dear to the Constitution and what has been laid down by the founding fathers, and not so much to expand influence. So that's a very interesting that's a very interesting statistic that I found, that the Indian state has waged is amongst the most warring democracies in the post World War II era.
I'm very interested in this statement because in your book as well, you cover what happens in Sri Lanka and Maldives. And I don't think they can be construed as sort of expansionary, but they are sort of interventionist in a sense.
Oh, yes. So certainly, you know, Prime Minister Indira Gandhi, many Western strategic scholars have attributed strains of a Monroe Doctrine that emerged from Prime Minister Indira Gandhi's strategic thinking. Now, India's intervention in Maldives was a result of a call for help from a neighbor. Similarly, India's intervention through the Indian peacekeeping force in Sri Lanka was in response to a call from a minority in Sri Lanka, which had close links to a large constituency of Tamils in India itself, for help. It was also construed as a means of helping a neighbor tackle a growing insurgency and terrorist movement in the form of the LTTE. So India's intervention abroad has never been unilateral, but it has always been under the umbrella of a bilateral accord or under the umbrella of a plea for help from a neighboring country or under the aegis of the United Nations.
Yeah, I think that's extremely fair. And when we go back to talking about Indian strategic thinking and how this is affected, it makes me wonder in terms of sort of the continuity of threats that we have always been cognizant of. I think India has been cognizant of state-sponsored terrorism ever since independence, though it sort of came into vogue in Western circles only, I think, around the time of 9/11. Whereas you have newer threats of cybersecurity that are coming up. How does sort of establishment thinking confront these new threats that exist while at the same time balancing old threats that continue? Yeah.
You know, if I were to identify a slow area within India's strategic community that is sort of impeding its ability to be nimble enough in coping with these new threats that you've spoken of, it is this whole issue of building intellectual capital. We live in a knowledge society, and I think warfare also has become increasingly domain-specific, knowledge-based, and a lot of war today is waged in the head and not so much on the ground or in aircraft or in weapon systems. And therefore, I think we've been a little slow off the block in developing adequate repository of intellectual capital within the national security establishment to cope with these burgeoning security threats.
Yes, I think I agree with you completely on that count. And it also makes me wonder in terms of now there's a lot of talk, not only in India, but countries around the world, of sort of building self-sufficiency. And it makes me wonder about sort of the technology gap. This is something that you've spoken about in the book as well, where you talk about how Indian fighter pilots made MiG fighter jets do things that even their makers did not envision them doing.
Yeah.
So how do you see sort of the technology gap playing out, and if sort of a return to self-sufficiency would address that in any way?
If one looks at it through a larger frame, if India wants to be a leading power in the years ahead, we have no option but to attain self-sufficiency in all niche areas of national security and defense capability. There is no two ways about it. Nobody is, however close you are, however close an ally is, nobody is going to part with strategic technologies that have taken decades to develop just because somebody has entered into an alliance with you or somebody is a close strategic partner. You will go up to a point and no more. So therefore, the whole drive for self-sufficiency is a no-brainer, absolutely. The problem is that how do you catch up? How do you catch up with competitors and adversaries, particularly with adversaries like China? And there is only one way in which you can do that, is by leapfrogging. And in order to leapfrog, you need to create intellectual capital and an innovative society at a breakneck speed. And in areas of innovation and building intellectual capital, that is where you can draw on expertise from strategic partners and friends. But the ultimate putting together of the pieces has to be in-house and has to be indigenous. I think that's the only way that India can aspire to be a leading power, say by 2050 or those kind of time frames. And yes, I think I will be able to sort of put my money by saying that if India is able to sort of design, develop, and manufacture a fifth generation fighter aircraft, when the West is developing a sixth generation fighter aircraft, I think that would be an indicator of rapid progress. Mm-hmm. And let's see, I think there is an intent and there is a kind of enthusiasm and energizing of the indigenous defense innovative spirit. So I'm hopeful that the next decade or decade and a half should see us leapfrogging a fair bit.
Fair enough. And this also makes me wonder, when you sort of go over all of this history, which is with a lot of research that you have done for these two books and elsewhere, it is sort of evident where the mistakes in strategy or operations or tactics lie. But at the same point, it's also evident that in the fog of war, you did not have all the information that you did to take the best decisions. So for yourself, when you were looking back at sort of the history of India's wars, how did you see sort of the main areas in which we were let down?
One of the areas that we've been let down is, you know, I may have sounded in my book at times a little critical of the intelligence gathering mechanism that was in place. Mm-hmm. So intelligence is one area which has both supported and which has also at times let down the final outcome. So one area, certainly every large state depends on intelligence to drive operational outcomes. Every established military relies on intelligence to derive targeting outcomes. On several occasions, the Indian military has generated and has been provided with adequate intelligence that have led to positive operational outcomes. And several times there have been occasions when there has been a suboptimal exploitation of intelligence, suboptimal availability of intelligence that has actually impeded operational outcomes. And let me, and there is another angle to intelligence as a driver of success or victory. There has to be a close connect between political objectives, intelligence gathering, and operational outcomes. If there is synergy and synchronization between all three, I think success is assured. When there is dissonance between any one of these instruments of statecraft or instruments of force, there are bound to be suboptimal outcomes. You know, for example, the Siachen operation is an example of political decisiveness, very focused intelligence gathering, and decisive operational outcomes. You know, Indira Gandhi gave the orders to, cleared the operation in Leh to occupy the Saltoro Ridge. The intelligence agencies, both the civilian intelligence agencies and the military intelligence, put the pieces together that allowed the Indian Army to understand that the Pakistan military was also going to make a run for the Saltoro Ridge. And they decided that they need to preempt the Pakistani move. So everything fell into place like clockwork. And 2 weeks before the Pakistanis reached the Saltoro Ridge, the Indians had already occupied Bila Fondla and Siala. Mm-hmm. Had they procrastinated for even 2 weeks, the Pakistanis would have occupied Bila Fondla and Siala. So everything worked like clockwork. However, you look at Sri Lanka. When there was dissonance between political outcomes or political objectives that that Prime Minister Rajiv Gandhi wanted to achieve, the haste with which General Sundarji wanted to move in operationally into Sri Lanka, and the lack of intelligence interfaces between the political establishment and the military, resulted in suboptimal outcomes in Sri Lanka. Let me give you a most recent example. Okay, now after the Galwan clash of June 15th, the operation that took place, Operation Snow Leopard, that took place on the 29th and 30th of August, in which the Indian Army occupied several heights on the North Bank and the South Bank, was a result of clear political directives that something has to be done in a finite time frame as a quid pro quo. There was adequate intelligence that was made available to the Indian Army that the Chinese were also planning a similar operation and that we needed to preempt them. There was adequate logistics backup, and the Indian Army went in confidently to occupy those heights, which sort of allowed us not to recover completely after the events of May, but at least to assert ourselves when negotiations move ahead. Now, this is another example wherein I think there was a realization that unless there was synergy between all instruments, we would not sort of drive a positive operational outcome. So intelligence, extremely important, and intelligence will only be successful when the flow of intelligence helps create an operational mosaic. And ultimately, that operational mosaic is needed for the general on the ground to be able to execute his operation.
I think this is very insightful, because you're right, this operational mosaic between political objectives, operational outcomes, and the intelligence is something, I guess, that holds a lot of our strategy in place.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, what has changed, or has anything changed in over the last couple of years in terms of whether it is gathering intelligence or relaying of that intelligence?
Oh, yes. If there's one thing that has changed, that is technology. Technological, it's called techint. If technological intelligence and signal intelligence holds the key today to almost every aspect of operational war fighting, whether it is in the subconventional domain or whether it is at the operational domain. And this is where a lot of thrust has been, put into several of our intelligence agencies to be able to aid operational outcomes. Do we have what we need? Of course not. For example, our space assets are significantly inadequate as compared to what the Chinese have in place. So, for example, if the Chinese have a constellation or a network of satellites that allow them to keep persistent stare over their areas of interest because of the number of passes over that area that their satellites can make, we don't have a similar situation. We are working towards it, but we are some years away from that kind of a situation. So therefore, how do we keep track of those remote areas? It has to be through a generation of intelligence gathering sensors, which is probably a generation older, probably UAVs, probably human intelligence, probably intelligence from strategic partners. So there are these gaps that need to be sort of filled in, and I think that is the thrust of our intelligence building network that is being put in place to support future war fighting.
The other thing that I want to get to is something that you also mentioned with intelligence is sort of the Galvan crisis. And I think the LAC, the line of actual control, from Sundarongchu to May 2020, it has gone through considerable change.
Yeah.
From a historian's perspective, what does the crisis of the last year tell us about the Indian Armed Forces' response across the LAC?
The thing is that there are several markers on this journey to studying the line of actual control. And I don't want to go back to the 40s and the 50s, but I want to take off from, say, the 1967 Nathula crisis that I write about in my book. 1967 was the first time that the Chinese realized that the Indians are not going to give in easily from now on along the line of actual control. Okay? Thereafter, this was validated 20 years later when at Sundarongchu, the Indians responded very, very strongly to an intrusion by the Chinese in Guangdong, right? That is when Deng Xiaoping was the strong man in China. And he realized that in order to achieve China's long-term goals of getting what they want along the line of actual control, he may have to institute mechanisms short of war in order to probably, he thought, lull the Indians into believing that the border problem would sort itself out with time. And that is why you had these slew of border, confidence-building measures along the line of actual control, which led to a lot of agreements, do's and don'ts, no-go areas, limits of patrolling, no-fly zones, no use of firearms, very, very tight diplomatic control from both Beijing and New Delhi as to what can be done along the line of actual control and what can be done. So therefore, over a period of time, the Indian Army got used to, and so did the Chinese, so did the PLA, get used to looking at the line of actual control as a management issue and not as a historical dispute. And this is where I think the Galvan crisis has removed what I call the smokescreen from Chinese intentions along the line of actual control. Now that smokescreen slowly started peeling off in 2014. And that coincides with a couple of years after President Xi Jinping took over, as leader for life, wherein slowly the PLA started probing India all along the line of actual control and met stiff resistance everywhere. And I think after Doklam, they realized that unless this time there was a concerted push at altering status quo, the same thing would repeat itself again and again, and the Chinese would not be able to realize any of their strategic objectives. And therefore, this time, I think the Chinese, three reasons for Galvan. One is the Chinese read too much into the creation of Ladakh as a union territory. And they looked at it as Indian strategies to try and creep towards its politically stated objective of Aksaychin, which everyone knows is an unrealizable objective. It's more of rhetoric that Aksaychin is ours. But that's what the Chinese felt, that, we need to preempt the Indians in case they are thinking of anything funny in this area. The second was Doklam was actually a fairly hard knock for the Chinese, even though, as General Prakash Menon says, that the Chinese have continued to build up infrastructure in Doklam. But the Doklam episode per se was a rap on their knuckles. The Indians refused to allow them to move up to the Jhamphiri Ridge. Now, to get even with that, I think the Chinese have been planning something for the last 2 years. And I think the entire incursions and transgressions in eastern Ladakh have been part of this overall plan for a concerted push to alter status quo. And once again, the Indian response was equally strong. So actually, we are back to square one along the line of actual control. But the status quo has been altered. Now the line of actual control is no longer going to be about managing, but it's going to be active. And when it is active, the potential for conflict increases manifold. I always say that this kind of an escalation along the line of actual control makes it more like the LOC, makes it more like the actual, the AGPL, which runs along the Saltoro Ridge in Siachen. So it's not a comfortable situation for both the PLA and the Indian Army. But things are not going to be the same henceforth.
I think it's a very poignant point that you bring out here, that the LAC is becoming more like the LOC in that sense. Also interesting, because I think Pakistan earlier this week said that Gilgit-Baltistan will become a part of a provincial, will be given provisional provincial status. And I just wonder if the LOC is also changing in that sense.
You know, I don't think there is too much of scope now for the LAC to change. The only way forward from the current imbroglio is, the only light at the end of the tunnel is if the leaders of India and China give up on historical legacies and engage more in the present. Only then can we see a solution. But otherwise, I don't see the LAC escalating to the level of the line of control with Pakistan, with these artillery engagements and things like that. But there is going to be far greater troop, positions along the LAC until something meaningful comes beyond these confidence building measures. Now there has to be a move forward with maps, delineation, demarcation, and finally resolution of the boundary crisis. The boundary problem has to be solved. The international boundary has to come up in the next few years. Otherwise, we are going to see the situation, and it's not going to be good for both countries.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point for us to sort of end that discussion on. My last question for you, Ibn, sir, is what books or resources would you recommend for people who are interested more in Indian military history or the history of India's armed forces?
That's a very exhaustive list. I'm saying both my books, both India's Wars and Full Spectrum, have a chapter right at the end of the book, which is called Essential Reading. And I clearly laid out about three or four books from each of these conflicts that would allow somebody to gather a holistic perspective of the Indian military, both from an Indian point of view and a Western point of view. Now, if you were to ask me off the cuff some really good books or some really good authors to look at, I would say for an introduction to 1971 and India's colonial legacy and stuff like that, I think Srinath Raghavan would be a good person to go back to. To get into the nitty-gritties of the India-Pakistan conflict. And, I think Sumit Ganguly would be an excellent person to read. His books like Deadly Impasse and Conflict Unending. He's written several books, and I think his first book on the India-Pakistan crisis is probably best, which is called Conflict Unending. As far as China is concerned, there are a lot of books about China from an individual perspective. B.N. Malik writes about China, the India-China crisis of 1962. Brigadier Dalvi writes about it. You have But I would recommend Bertil Lindner, a more recent scholar of Tibet and of India-China relations. His couple of books are extremely instructive and interesting to read. As far as, you know, there's lots of reading about 1971. John Garver has written a book, Protracted Contest, about the India-China rivalry from a Western perspective. That's a fantastic book. And more recently, you have several scholars who've been sort of writing about Indian military modernization, Stephen Cohen, Stephen Wilkinson, you know, arming without aiming. So there is a whole lot of reading to be there. And if I were to look at some pure Indian scholars, you know, Air Chief Marshal Lal has written a wonderful book, My Years in the Indian Air Force. It not only gives you an insight into the Indian Air Force, but also, you know, into jointmanship, the early struggles of jointmanship. You have several excellent biographies of Thimaya and Sagat Singh and Manekshaw. So there is a whole wealth, there is a whole repository of reading that's available out there. And I would strongly recommend to your listeners that those of you know, those of them who've picked up these two books would do well to sort of go to the end and look at that essential reading chapter, and they will find a whole lot of information about what books to read to get to know India's armed forces better.
Amazing. Thank you so much, AVM. So thank you for coming on the show and for giving us all of your insights and for these wonderful recommendations.
Thank you very much, Hamsini. It was nice talking to you. And keep doing these shows. They're good to listen to. And more importantly, they add to the repository, of building intellectual capital within young people. And I know that a lot of young people listen to these podcasts. And so I think you're doing a great job.
That's such an honor coming from you. Thank you so much, sir.
Thanks, Hamsini.
That's it for this episode of States of Anarchy. Thank you for staying with us. I've attached reading suggestions in the episode description as always, so do go check those out. If you have any questions or comments, don't hesitate to reach out to me at HamsiniH on Twitter and at States of Anarchy on Instagram. We also host a quiz every weekend on our Instagram page, so do tune in. If you want to help us reach more people, you can leave us a rating on iTunes or whatever podcast app you use. You can listen to States of Anarchy, not only on the IVM podcast app and website, but on Spotify, iTunes, Gaana, Google Podcasts, or whatever you're using right now. We'll be back soon with a new episode. Till then, stay safe, stay healthy.